Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who's just back from screaming at an angry healthcare hearing, Rick Hess.
I was screaming at that hearing. I was saying, why don't you guys listen to each other a little more? Why don't you empathize with each other a little more? Why don't we span this chasm that is tearing our nation apart?
So, Rick, it seems to me, and I wrote this the other day, that, you know, compared to the healthcare debate, the education debate seems relatively placid. I mean, we don't see people really getting all this fired up and marching in the streets over education reform.
Although, I mean, to be fair, healthcare is at a boil right now. 12 months ago, nobody was marching in the streets over healthcare.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, during, you know, when you think about the height of some of the pushback on NCLB, Utah, Connecticut, some of the,
Nobody was marching in the streets.
Sure they were.
I mean, you had angry op-eds in the newspapers, but who was marching in the streets?
In Utah, they had a pitchfork or two. I'm sure of it.
I mean, I think the last time we had this kind of, you know, fever pitch in education was in the early 70s with the backlash to busing.
Sure. But, I mean, that was also the last time that you really had D.C. officials aggressively trying to take control over something very close to people's lives.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if, for instance, you saw an NCLB re-auth, in which the feds were saying, you know what, we want to do away with the Matt Miller agenda. We want to do away with school boards. We want to impose a national curriculum. Mm-hmm. I think you would see something a lot like what we're watching right now with healthcare.
Okay. But you know what it mostly makes me know is that, let's face it, education always has to fight for attention.
Oh, for these other issues. Oh, that's nonsense. Jeez.
Well, I mean, come on. It's not exactly at the top of people's
agenda. Yes, that's because what's at the top of the agenda right now is people are worrying about whether or not we're melting the planet, and people are worried about where we're going to come up with $1 trillion in a possible federal takeover of healthcare.
Yeah, well, having a better educated population is going to help us solve those problems, Rick.
Oh, right. I heard that speech. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Oh, yeah.
Okay, lots of things to cover today. By the way, nice to see you again, Rick. It's been a while since both of us have been on the show.
It really has.
I know. We've been taking vacations. We've been
lollygagging. But you look tan, rested, ready.
I do. I feel tan, rested, and ready. So, lots to cover. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. Mm-hmm. We're going to have the Research Minute from Amber. She's here. Everybody should be excited about that. And we're going to rate that reform to the extent that there are any reforms happening in the middle of August.
That can be rated.
Okay. So we have intern Shelley with us today to lead Pardon the Gadfly.
Great.
That was a pregnant pause.
Oh, and by the way, I think it was last week that I had to cuff Mick around a little bit on the old NPR voice. So yeah, we'll see if intern Shelley brings the heat.
All right. Intern Shelley, your big shot.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg finally got the New York State Legislature to extend his control over the city's schools. They added some new requirements around transparency, oversight, and community outreach. Was it a good deal for reform?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, there you go.
Okay, so let's talk some more about Shelley's delivery. That was pretty good.
That was pretty sharp. Very on that very kind of mellifluous NPR style.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, on the New York action, I mean, I think, A, it's a good thing that they, you know, renewed mayoral control. I think, from where I'm standing, that New York City is in a heck of a lot better position today than it was 7-8 years ago. And two, I think the conditions they tacked on are perfectly reasonable. In fact, I think several times we have adopted mayoral control in cities without paying enough attention to how do you ensure transparency and some checks in terms of making sure that the information flows don't get closed off.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the issue, is we have this sense that we've got these big urban systems that get bogged down in politics, and so we want to get rid of all of that, give all the authority in one person, and then we see the flip side, is that parents who have a real beef with something that's happening, they have no effective way of getting those concerns at least heard, voiced, and perhaps acted upon. And so I think it's tricky. I mean, you could... I understand the argument that says anytime you provide these checks, that could slow down the executive from getting things done. On the other hand, in most parts of our government, we accept that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we accept that, you know, President Obama can't just do whatever he wants to do on healthcare. He's got to convince the Congress, and that makes things slow and complicated, but that's our system.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, just the point about the aspiration for male control being to get politics out of schooling. I mean, one, that's nuts, because the reforms we're dealing with right now were supposed to get politics out of school in a century ago.
Right.
And two, the idea that you give something to mayors because you want it to be depoliticized
right.
is just kind of a funny line.
Right. Okay. Topic number two.
Some districts are trimming their bus routes and eliminating service for some kids as a strategy to save money. Is this a good target for belt tightening?
Well, now see, I look at this and I say, this isn't crazy. I mean, there could be some opportunities here to tighten the belt and to say, you know, particularly in big urban systems, you might be able to get by without bus service in some parts of the city if you've got good municipal bus services. Sometimes those are duplicative. So I think it's reasonable as people are looking for ways to save money. But what do you think, Rick? I mean, is this a cop-out?
I think it's both reasonable and it's a cop-out. I mean, I think what you said is exactly right. We don't often take a hard look at these things. Sometimes districts, by doing something as simple as rejiggering start times for middle schools, for instance, can get more carries per operation of a bus because they can use buses for additional schools. So it's certainly worth looking at. But look, the problem here is every time you hear districts talk about cutting, it's something that they can shave off. They're going to have to do away with a few teachers. They're going to have to stop getting materials or can't renew textbooks. The way that well-run organizations address shortfalls is they go back and they try to figure out, can we rethink what we're doing so that this is an opportunity to become more productive and to allocate our resources more efficiently? Closing down bus routes might make sense, but there's no evidence here that folks are actually trying to step back and say, can we deliver the same quality education with fewer staff? Can we deliver the same quality education using new tools? And frankly, you have to look really hard and really far to find even a handful of districts that are engaged in that conversation.
So you mean, for example, what, that hey, why don't we look at being very aggressive about virtual schooling in our district, for example, and see if that could be a way to deliver some courses better and in a much cheaper way?
Absolutely. If we can use new vendor products to allow teachers to save 5, 10, 15% of their time because they no longer have to do K-2 diagnostics by hand, they can now use software platforms. That means teachers can handle 5, 10, 15% more kids without actually spending any less time per child. These are not the kinds of calculations that you see districts engage in.
Okay. Topic number three, Shelley.
The new Rhode Island State Superintendent, Deborah Gist, is pushing a new requirement that all districts in the Ocean State have rigorous teacher evaluation systems. This might help tiny Rhode Island get big bucks from the Race to the Top fund. Is this worth celebrating? Will such efforts make a difference?
I didn't know Rhode Island was called the Ocean State.
That's correct. It is.
That's neat. Yeah. I think this is certainly a sensible effort. I think, in fact, it's got a lot to recommend it over these efforts to come up with statutory or mandatory statewide accountability systems. I don't think we know what the right way to do teacher accountability, in terms of teacher accountability systems.
Yeah, but I think, my sense is that it is a statewide mandatory.
I thought, my understanding was that she was encouraging districts to devise.
Well, I think they're right. I mean, so basically she's saying every district has to have a teacher evaluation system. It's got to be much more rigorous than the ones they've got now. And I think there's some fair level of specificity, you might say prescription, in what those systems have got to look
like. So I guess it depends, right? That's right. I mean, I think optimally you want to see less prescription on this. I'd like to see districts push to try to figure out how to do this. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see districts trying to tackle it in different ways.
Yeah.
And to see a number of smart approaches of
March. Right, but see, Rick, here's my problem with some of the teacher evaluation conversation right now. I mean, it's certainly at the top of the agenda. The widget report that the New Teacher Project put out a few months ago got a lot of attention, clearly had a huge impact on the criteria for the Race to the Top application. There's this mindset, though, among a lot of reformers, I would say the Ed Trust of the world and some others, that say, you know, If what we can do is get more information that shows people how meaningless these teacher evaluations are, that will shame districts into taking teacher evaluation more seriously, right? The problem is, right now, if you're a principal, you have no incentive to give a teacher a bad evaluation because you still can't do anything to get that teacher out of your classroom. It doesn't mean, so all you're going to do is create ill will, you know, and have somebody angry at you for giving them a bad evaluation. It seems to me, To think of teacher evaluations as somehow separate from the conversation of what can you do, what decisions can you make based on those teacher evaluations is ludicrous.
Absolutely.
And so we have to align those incentives. Right now, principals are acting perfectly rationally and saying, you know what, I'm just going to give everybody a good evaluation because otherwise I'm just going to make people angry at me and that's not going to make anybody do their job any better.
No, that's a terrific point. And in fact, in almost any state, the premier systems, that approach actually works relatively well. Because these are systems that are attracting a lot of talented teachers. The principals are, as long as they just kind of stay out of everybody's way and just kind of lead with a light hand on the till, it'll work out. One of the problems with statewide systems is you start to drive Montgomery counties and the Fairfax is crazy because they say we've got lots of high-performing teachers. Why are you, you know, complicating our lives? And you get immense pushback. One of the advantages of pushing accountability linked to incentives and management flexibility on a more localized basis is that you can actually lead from the districts where folks want to do this, where they actually need to do this.
Well, again, here's how I would put it, is we keep thinking there's a technocratic solution here, if we can get the technology of teacher evaluation right. You know, whereas I think, look, the conversation should be this: can we give principals real discretion to make decisions around staffing? That's a political discussion about, you know, are we willing to trust principals or not? And until we get to that, I think we're just kidding ourselves.
But politically, you can only get that started once you've got something better in terms of teacher evaluation.
I guess so.
But I'm with you on that. And I think you're right that this technocratic romanticism gets in the way.
Technocratic romanticism. All right.
Speaking of which.
We know who's with us now. It's Amber's Research Minute. Amber, do you consider yourself more of a romantic or a technocrat?
Romantic.
Oh,
beautiful.
That is.
Anyway, we won't go into that.
Especially romantic when the right technocrats are around.
Yes. The Tom D's of the world.
The Tom Kane's, the Dan Goldhabers.
Well, we haven't revisited that in a while, have we? I was hoping that was buried. Anyway.
All right, Amber, what are we talking about today?
All right, this week we have an exploratory study by Marguerite Rosa that explores the trade-offs that a hypothetical cash-strapped district might have to make if forced to trim 5% from its teacher salary expenditures, which is where the bulk of district spending lies and where districts are loath to make cuts anyway. So in such a situation, higher wages typically mean teacher layoffs and class size increases, and reduced wages typically mean you can save jobs and maintain class sizes. Rosa uses the average teacher salary increase, which is 3%, and the average cost of living adjustment, which is 2%, to calculate her figures. She explores a variety of scenarios under a 5% cut, including doing nothing, freezing the current salary schedule, and rolling back the salary schedule. She finds that the business-as-usual approach, which is where we keep the salary steps and the COLA adjustments, means 143 layoffs per 1,000 teachers, which would cause class sizes to rise by about 17%. If salaries are frozen, reducing expenditures would require 75 layoffs per 1,000 teachers, which is a little better. Finally, if you completely want to avert layoffs and class size increases, the entire salary schedule would need to be rolled back, meaning the average teacher salary would need to decline by 5%. Bottom line, you can't expect to keep jobs, maintain class sizes, and avoid layoffs in a declining economy. Tough choices have to be made.
Tough choices. What do you think, Rick? Which choice would you make if you were running a school?
I think
you didn't seem all that upset about the idea of 17% increase in class size.
Not terribly, and I'm also not terribly concerned about teachers taking pay cuts, just like everybody else in the economy.
That's right.
You know, I think one of the problems is when reformers try to go out and say what the right solution is. If we'd have district leadership that were actually saying, "Here's our limited number of resources. We want to suck it up. We want to make hard choices." Then I'd be happy to abide by whatever decision they made.
Yep. And look, and you do see this in some places. We should not be so negative. I mean, I was impressed in here in Montgomery County, Maryland, that the teacher unions agreed to forego their planned raises under their contract, you know, because they understood the financial situation the county was under.
Mm-hmm.
That was very impressive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a really intriguing study, you know. I mean, she's just top notch. I mean, she just did all these different scenarios. You could see how it worked out, and you know, you could see it as you know, as the salaries froze and reduced, you know, everything just sort of evened out. You know, it was just a neat study. She's doing this series of rapid response studies that I just think pack a lot of information in a really accessible fashion.
Mm-hmm. All right. All Amber, right. Thank you. So what's the song that goes along
with
this?
So we're talking about tough choices that need to be made and keeping or booting teachers. So we have Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash.
Should
Great
I stay
song.
Or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble.
Oh, I love it.
What
you know,
a
this
great song.
Seems like a good moment then to just mourn the passing of John Hughes, the great film director from the 1980s. I don't know if that song appeared in any of his movies.
I don't believe it did.
No?
He was pretty young, too, wasn't he?
He was 59.
59, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which meant he did Breakfast Club, and he was like 34.
Yeah. Now that is an accomplishment.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Which of those movies is your favorite, Rick, when you think back on that?
Oh, man.
I mean, you were definitely of that era, right?
Oh, I think 16 Candles.
Yeah.
You know John Cusack was in 16 Candles? Folks don't often remember this.
I remember I read that the other day, and I can't picture.
He was one of Michael Anthony Hall's sidekicks.
Okay. Interesting. I got to put a vote in for Ferris Bueller's Day Off. One of my favorite all-time movies.
Ugh, have you seen all these stuff?
Of course.
And yours really? Fave is?
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Mm-hmm.
But you took a class on this in college about 1980s.
Very funny.
Staff grew up on Home Alone.
Whatever. I love the Home Alone movies. Well, Macaulay Culkin is a...
Yeah. About. Okay, Stafford. I'm filling the airtime a little bit because I'm assuming it's mid-August. We got no reform to rate, but tell me if I'm wrong.
We do have a reform to rate, but mid-August, we are going to Asia for our reform.
So, Stafford, tell us what's happening in Asia.
Okay, so this story comes to us from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. An exemplary student was caught with a lighter and a cigarette in his locker. This 16-year-old's teacher was outraged at his unhealthy behavior and decided he must be punished. No detention for this teen. The teacher forced the boy to smoke close to 2 packs of cigarettes in under 2 hours. 4 at a time, in fact. When questioned about these measures, the teacher said the number was, quote, not more than 42 cigarettes and would not elaborate further. A school official tried to explain the punishment by saying, quote, this is not normal. We don't do that often. No definition of often was provided. The point here was to get the boy to stop smoking. The teacher probably made the teen sick from all those smokes. Then again, maybe he just so overloaded the boy's system with nicotine that he turned into an addict on the spot. Without further information on the boy's post-42 cigarette incident, it's hard to tell, so I'll give it a C. But as for the punishment itself, this defines cruel and unusual, not to mention having detrimental long-term health consequences to a T. Or should I say F, as in the grade this one deserves.
I think this is unfair. We're speaking of the 80s, okay? Do you remember the Different Strokes episode where I forget the older kid, but he, you know, he got caught drinking. Willis, right. And his dad makes him, you know, like, drink a whole, more shots of whiskey or something. Yeah, get sick. And I mean, this has been a classic way of teaching teenagers not to do the stupid stuff for decades.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
But
the consequences of your actions, huh?
Not in a government-sanctioned school. I mean,
well, keep in mind that this is a country where the allowed sanctions include caning.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and doesn't like the American Medical Association or somebody say that within like 30 days of quitting smoking, your lungs are already half 50% back? So even if the kid had 42 cigarettes, kid's probably young enough that a year and a half out, it'll be like you never smoked any of them.
That's a fair point, too. All right. Nice job, Stafford. I appreciate your willingness to go global.
I scrounged the internet for you,
yes,
Mike.
Excellent. All right. That is all the time we have this week. Thanks for joining us in this special summer edition of the Education Gadfly Show. Till next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.